time now for an open news section where we will look at stories that may become topics for our next program. Now, for our first story, we're going to take a look at China and its rejection of big tech. This article stated that China's rejection of big tech monopoly capitalism is the focus for China, and it doesn't want to basically see China going the route that the U.S. has done. First of all, how is it going to be able to do that? Well, it's going to refuse allowing its homegrown technology companies to be dominant in the way that Amazon and Google are in the West. We can mention Alibaba, for example. And basically, it wants to put its focus on manufacturing, to make a long story short. Next up, BRICS Summit. It had one, and the BRICS nations composed of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. It's an important meeting. Have met the host country, even though it was a virtual meeting, but I should say the host was the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. And he focused on three things, which were the theme of the summit, the three C's: cooperation, for continuity, and consolidation. Now, BRICS is still relevant because it does have investments for its member countries into different sectors. Next up, U.S. national debt, obviously a big factor for the U.S., and it's on track to default, as of the recording of this program, on its national debt for the month of October. We have to wait and see if that happens. By the time this program gets aired, maybe it's going to be solved. But it's an ongoing problem. Basically, the Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, said that if this happens and the debt limit is not raised, it will be the first time in U.S. history. This is basically has come out to be a bipartisan theatrical politics, so to speak, because at the end it always gets solved. Finally, breaking U.S. sanctions. Yes, Iran has done it again, delivering its first fuel shipment to Lebanon. That is a big deal because it shows that U.S. sanctions did not work. Iran is invincible towards it. In this particular case, Lebanon needs the fuel badly. The way it did it, it entered Syria to transfer to Lebanon and did that via tankers.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section. Here we are going to devote what the U.S. may lose by focusing on China after pulling out of Afghanistan. First, the U.S. needs China more than China needs the U.S. economically speaking. For example, the U.S. depends heavily on China for providing low-cost goods. Now, this is especially applicable when it comes to income-constrained American consumers. Now, these are American consumers who are having a hard time making ends meet. Now, moving on to the other area where the U.S. depends on China, it has to deal with exports. China is America's third largest export market, next to Mexico and Canada. That obviously is something that should concern the U.S. Now, the U.S. also depends on China to provide funding for its budget deficit. You can see over here, $1.3 trillion is how much debt or foreign holder of U.S. Treasury securities China has in direct ownership. Imagine a lack of Chinese buying. That could turn the next Treasury auction into a rout. And finally, this is a bit of truth that is the outcome of the structure of the U.S. economy's weakness when it comes to Americans' spending habits. America depends on China because Americans don't have enough savings. For example, in the fourth quarter of 2017, the net domestic saving rate was just 1.3%. That was the national income. Now, how will it be able to increase Americans' savings? Well, in order to consume and grow, the U.S. must import surplus foreign savings from abroad. That is the naked truth. And run massive balance of payments and trade deficits to import this capital. But how can it do that when the U.S. had trade deficits with 102 nations? That's right, 102 nations. Okay, let's bring in William Jones for a breakdown. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Executive Intelligence Review and a non-resident fellow of Pyongyang Institute for Financial Studies. Bill Jones, welcome. Why did the U.S. fall behind China, estimated to take over the U.S. as the number one economy by the year 2028? I mean, is it because of the U.S. spending monies on wars, for example, across the globe and its military bases, instead of focusing on things like infrastructure or education and scientific development in areas like 5G?
Well, obviously, the situation of Afghanistan has created a situation where the United States, which is pulled out, doesn't really have much influence on the development in Afghanistan. They have no representations on site. They're withholding money to the Taliban and waiting and see what happens. China, on the other hand, has really taken a forward position here. They do have a relationship with the Taliban. They are willing to help. The Taliban, in its turn, has said that they really would want to work with China. So, but the U.S. is still concerned with what happens in Afghanistan because it doesn't want it to become a center of terrorism and have the same problems they had 20 years ago with the 9/11 situation. Will the United States stop their freedom of navigation forays into the China Sea? Will they stop trying to impose a technological apartheid on China through trade tariffs? And like, I don't think that's going to happen. But there has to be some give in this situation on the part of the U.S. in order to maintain stability in the relationship.
The story of the U.S. losing its status as a so-called superpower is being highlighted these days, especially after its messy withdrawal from Afghanistan. Marred by COVID-19, its economy has not fully recovered from the pandemic.
There's still clearly a huge amount of open positions. There's still clearly a shortage in some industries. There's still clearly a problem with some industries that require more certifications and things like that that are time dependent.
In the meantime, under these harsh circumstances for the U.S., it is insisting on confronting China. China, in the meantime, has achieved success in its fight against poverty. It has put forth the grand vision under the leadership of its president, Xi Jinping, to vitalize its rural areas in its fight against poverty.
President Xi Jinping rightly celebrates the success of China's targeted poverty alleviation campaign, which by the end of last year, 2020, had brought about 100 million of the intractably poor out of extreme poverty. For China to achieve the Chinese dream of national rejuvenation, eliminating extreme poverty was necessary. But it was not sufficient. China must continue to fight poverty by reducing still substantial relative poverty and close the still excessive wealth gap, primarily between rural and urban areas. Enhancing rural standards of living exemplifies China's long-range vision to the years 2035 and 2050, when China's goal is to become a fully modernized socialist nation. And President Xi allows no delay in making the historic transition from poverty alleviation to rural vitalization. Without the vitalization of the countryside, there can be no social stability, no common prosperity, no national rejuvenation. But while grand visions are formulated by central leadership, they must be implemented by local grassroots officials.
It has also issued a white paper to elaborate on its prosperity. The white paper said that China had completed the historic transformation from poverty to securing access to food and clothing, to a decent life, and finally, to moderate prosperity. This against the unsuccessful backdrop of U.S. efforts.
They've also gone for poverty, the first country, biggest country in the world, which has effectively eliminated extreme poverty. We haven't even done that in the United States. And those are things that I think should be markers for most countries and for humanity at large. And most of the countries in the world realize that this is a positive element here, and they want to work together with it. So I don't think they're going to simply follow the bugle call of the United States to go to a conflict.
But the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan has one main purpose, to secure its resources and to channel it against China. And it is not just Afghanistan that the U.S. has withdrawn its forces from. drawdowns have been reported in Iraq and in Syria, with Yemen to maybe in the works. The West Asia region is no longer of U.S. interest, and the reason may be purely for profits. Brown University's Costs of War Project released a report that revealed that the Pentagon spending totaled over $14 trillion since the start of the war in Afghanistan, with one-third to one-half of the total going to military contractors. A large portion of these contracts, one-quarter to one-third of all Pentagon contracts in recent years, have gone to just five major corporations: Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman. The report explained how China is the new justification for military spending. The most likely impact of the shift towards China will be to further tighten the grip of major weapons makers like Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, and Raytheon Technologies on the Pentagon budget, as the report reads.
Well, I think the U.S. Current relative decline has multiple sources. One, of course, is that after 9/11, the U.S. has very much invested in the so-called war on terror, and invests so much that its domestic need has not been met. So over the years, we've seen numbers like very high numbers that the U.S. has invested in its war capabilities, and it's deploying military around the world, particularly in the Middle East and in Central Asia. So that's really a waste of money. However, a small group of Americans really benefited from this, and the U.S. Stock market, the capital market, also benefit from this. During this time, as you said, there are many domestic problems should be taken care of, but not being taken care of because of political divide within the United States. So, and you know, political difficulties blocking that solution. So as we've seen over the past two decades, the infrastructure is lagging behind, and also there's a serious problem of social and economic gap between the rich and the poor. So moving forward, I think the number one priority for the U.S. should taking care of its domestic problem instead of intervening into other countries' internal affairs.
Southeast Asia will take a major economic hit if shipping is either disrupted or, worse yet, blocked in the South China Sea. Now, that's one of the points of conflict between the U.S. and China in what is known as the South China Sea conflict, and in particular, how that serves as a trade route. Now, the U.S. wants to take the revenues produced in that region. That's somewhat of an assumption, but it seems like that is the U.S.'s goal, to take those revenues away from China or decrease it by a substantial amount. Well, to get the final comments from our guest, Jia Hai, who's a research fellow at the Institute of World Economics, and also Bill Jones, who's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Executive Intelligence Review, both rejoining us for this final segment. Jia, I'm going to start with you and our final question. The U.S. superpower status downgraded by many across the world, many analysts, be it militarily or in the economic sphere, but the U.S. is still pursuing China. On a military level, does the U.S. alienation mean that it will not have the support of countries, not only in the Asia region, but also in Europe and elsewhere, in the respect where they're not going to be on board with it to confront China?
Well, I think, first of all, the U.S. continue to be the world's most powerful country, that's for sure. Even though with current relative decline, the U.S. still maintain a superior military power comparing to all the rest of the world combined, pretty much. So I think in that respect, U.S. continue to lead in its military realm. However, the world is now diversifying, and there are multipolar other powers arising, and this world order is changing from the post-Cold War unipolar into a multipolar world. Many other countries, including Europe and China and other developing countries' groupings, are having a say in international affairs. So U.S. has no monopoly on many other issues. Many other countries can contribute in the area of like the pandemic or climate change or urgent issues that the humanities are facing currently.
All right. Well, Bill, the U.S. superpower status downgraded by many, as was mentioned here, whether it's militarily or in the economic sphere, and it has fallen behind China. which is set to overtake the U.S. Economically by the year 2028 for it to be the number one economy. Is it because of the U.S. spending expenditures on wars across the globe that this has happened to the U.S.? We could mention military bases and military spending overall.
Well, yes, that latter is both are the case. The fact that they have spent a lot of money in military wars, which have led really nowhere except to further devastation. Afghanistan is a prime example of that. You can also look in the Middle East and see the same type of situation. But also there's been an utter neglect of investment in science and technology. And what the Chinese have done, with a population of 1.4 billion people, by the way, is they have followed much the example that the United States was following in the 1960s. We have to continue, you know, exerting ourselves. The almighty dollar will buy whatever we need, and therefore we don't have to do a lot of investment in science and technology, so that they became, in many respects, backwards, and the Chinese have moved forward. U.S. still remains a major scientific power, and I'm sure
the so-called superpower status of the U.S. is in jeopardy, and the U.S. is declining in its might, both in its economy and also its military. Yes, even the military, because the U.S. can't win a conflict by air, and its ground forces, well, they couldn't even defeat the Taliban when they had 100,000 forces combined with NATO forces in that country. And now they want to take on China in the business and military arena. So desperate that the U.S. had to send its VP Harris recently to Asia to rally support around her during her recent visit of the regional countries, that is. And as far as U.S. war adventurism is concerned, Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, need I say more? No wins there. So obviously, remains to be seen how the U.S. is going to be able to even penetrate China's sphere economically and militarily. That does it for this edition of the program. Thanks for tuning in. When we cover Tafway and the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Today I have made a trip to the beautiful city of Neishabur in Khorasan Razavi province. And my destination is a part of the nature of this great city, the Haftqar Valley. Stay with me. Neishabur is the second populated city of Khorasan Razavi province after the city of Mashhad. Neishabur has become a symbol of Iranian culture and history because of its rich culture and long history. This city is located on the foothills of Binalud mountain range, so its nature is untouched and extraordinary. Haftqar Valley, literally Seven Caves Valley, is a beautiful valley north of Neishabur. Haftqar Valley has a special red clay which is highly considered by environmentalists and climatologists. Haftqar Valley has nothing to do with a cave. Rather, the similarity of these valleys, defiles to caves, have made it to be called by this name. The impact of soil erosion in this valley gives it a new shape after every rainfall. The precipitation also makes temporary seasonal waterfalls. I am now in Haftqar Valley of Neishabur. Across from me, there are red-colored rocks, which I cannot describe their beauty and magnificence. You have to be here to realize what I'm saying. And beside me, there are many trees and bushes, which I don't know their names, unfortunately. However, they have given a special green look to this region. What a pretty spring! The sound of this spring makes me calm. And it has cool water. The water of this spring is not drinkable because it has many minerals. Such kinds of springs and rivers are abundant in Haftqar Valley. Look, there is a deep, beautiful split in the heart of this red rock. I better get closer. Oh, what a steep slope. Oh, please do remember that you have to be in a good physical condition if you want to take a tour here. Oh, at last I arrived. Oh, what a cozy corner. I'd like to sit here and take a rest. As if all the peace and calm in the world is in here.
Until next time, goodbye. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Mustaf. This comment was made by families of the five slain nuclear scientists who were allegedly assassinated by Israeli agents. Now, the households of the victims have filed a lawsuit against the U.S. for its support for Tel Aviv and what people here call terrorist activities against Iran.
I believe the reason that they did this in front of my eyes and my mother's eyes was to terrorize people. That's what terrorists do.
We have already gotten too late into this legal proceeding. They killed my husband 12 years ago, and I still feel the pain. It's not easy to forget such a great loss. The point is, America and Israel do not feel sorry for this, and that's why we ask Iranian and international judicial systems to bring the perpetrators to justice.
Iran does not recognize Israel as a country. This is why the case is not directly aimed at Israel, but is targeting the U.S. as a supporting force behind Tel Aviv. If succeeded, the move will lead to the freezing of American assets in foreign countries.
We are now waiting for the verdict of Iran's Court for International Affairs. We will follow up the case in countries that maintain judicial cooperation with Iran. There, we will demand that U.S. assets be blocked and transferred as compensation to the families of the victims. This is to remind the criminal governments that their crimes will not go unanswered.
Israel has a history of targeted killing of Iranian nuclear scientists since 2010. While Tel Aviv has not commented on any of the assassinations, its footsteps can be traced in all of the incidents. In this video, recorded in 2018, ex-Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gives the game away.
Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Abad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
Less than 2 years after this comment, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was a key Iranian nuclear scientist, was assassinated. Over the years, different American and Israeli officials have spoken openly about, quote, taking down the nuts and bolts of Iran's nuclear industry. The plaintiffs here say the U.S. was trying to do so by killing Iranian nuclear scientists, and today by enforcing the so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. But they say both measures have so far failed, and the West is now urging Iran to sit and talk about its nuclear program in Vienna to revive the 2015 nuclear pact.
Plaintiffs here hope that their lawsuit against the U.S. will break the chain of Washington's targeting of the Iranian scientific community. But they say the underlying messages are even more important, as the case lays bare the U.S.'s double standards with regards to human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In many cities in France, anti-health pass protesters marched again in what has become a weekly protest. They do not agree with the mandatory measures the French government has established to obtain much more vaccinations. But the protest movement is weakening a bit. Important figures of the Yellow Vests want to re-engage with the original inquiries of the movement, more social justice and against the authoritarian policy of the government. They want to elaborate a political force that will be able to influence the 2022 presidential elections.
Today we are with the angry citizens against the health pass, but as the Yellow Vest movement, we continue demanding more social justice and less taxes and a participative democracy.
70% of the French have received two jabs of the anti-COVID vaccine. Due to the health pass that people have to show in almost every public places, the virus is soon to be under control, and life in France is slowly returning back to normal. The National Institute on Economic Studies, INSEE, announced that the French gross domestic product, GDP, will increase with more than 6% in 2021. after a fall last year of 10%. This is good news for the economy, except that workers' rights are deeply affected by the COVID crisis. More and more people lose their full-time contract, which is often transformed in variable working hours and a temporary contract, less paid, and most of all, offering less job security.
I am a volunteer worker. I see the misery. We distribute food. There is much more misery now, and more young people are in need.
During the lockdown, people with precarious contracts were affected the most. Today, the government of Macron is reforming the unemployment status. He makes the labor market very flexible. He takes advantage of this crisis to implement his antisocial policy.
French President Macron had once declared that an unemployed person just has to cross the street to find a job. For many people, this is only wishful thinking.
The vaccination campaign is certainly successful in pushing back the COVID virus and putting the economy back on track. But the French population remains deeply divided about the mandatory health pass. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
One of the major border crossing points between Pakistan and Afghanistan. For decades, on an average, every day, tens of thousands of people have been making back and forth movements on both sides of 2,700-kilometer long porous border. After the return of the Taliban in Afghanistan, many Afghans are using Pakistan as a transit route to leave for Western destinations, given 70% unemployment in the neighboring country. However, weeks before and after the Taliban's takeover, the Western media have reported such routine traveling of Afghan citizens as being fresh influx of refugees into Pakistan, something the visiting UN High Commissioner have not denied to be the case.
The situation is better because there is no fighting. I have often been asked, is there big refugee movements? We have not seen big refugee movements, but of course, if the state collapses, we could see a lot of people trying to seek refuge in other countries. If the state ceases to function, this will provoke a crisis that is much bigger than humanitarian.
The UNHCR has reported nearly 500,000 internally displaced Afghan citizens inside Afghanistan. Their houses were bombarded by the US and the former Afghan Air Force during clashes with the Taliban in the major urban centers like Kandahar, Herat, and Kunduz. Rest of Afghanistan largely fell to the Taliban after the US-trained Afghan army surrendered without any fighting.
We must make sure that displaced people can either go back to their homes, and some people are going back to their homes, or if they are displaced, they are under a shelter. And you know, many are not. Many are out in the open, sleeping rough.
Analysts point out that the real problem in Afghanistan is deteriorating economy, as Afghan financial system has been dependent at least 60% on foreign aid. With a change of guard in Kabul, the Western countries and the UN have resumed funding, which is far less than what the new government requires to stabilize the fragile economy. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
One of the world's largest democracies, and on the wall of the parliament, which represent democracy, there is a sentence which reads Vasudeva Kutumbakam. It means the world is one family, and this is considered the most important moral value of the Indian society. But this is apparently not the case anymore, considering the growing discord in the society. In recent months, attacks against Muslim hawkers have come under the spotlight in social media. Critics say hate crimes against Muslims increased after the emergence of the Hindu nationalist government of the ruling BJP.
In India, from over close to a decade, the Muslim poor community is being further marginalized. This is being done by boycotting the Muslim hawkers and small Muslim traders.
Experts say in India, the political notion has changed from a strong secular nation to a theocratic Hindu nation, which has given rise to violence against Muslims. Now, Hindu extremists have been busy running this show through social media. Experts say the country, which is apparently known as the world's largest democracy, is under grave danger of losing this title. In a nation of diverse ethnic and religious groups. Now even beggars are being humiliated and intimidated just because of their faith and are asked to leave the country since they are Muslims. Based on reports by several rights groups, since the ruling BJP came to power in 2014, it has adopted various laws and taken actions that legitimize discrimination against the religious minorities and stigmatize critics of the government. Experts believe it could lead to instability in the world's most populous nation.
Everything is being done to further marginalize Muslims, including hate speeches, hate crimes, mob lynching, the citizenship law, criminalizing divorce, etc. Now they are picking on traders and vendors who weaken the Muslim community economically.
The ruling party of the Prime Minister Modi has fervently denied any discrimination against the community, saying India is a democracy and believes in equal rights for all. But critics say Prime Minister Modi's slogan of everyone together, development for all, and everyone's trust is nothing but a political tool to appease the voters as usual. Munawar Zaman, Press TV, New Delhi.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip took part in Friday prayer in front of the headquarters of the Red Cross. The event, organized by different Palestinian factions, aims to support Palestinian prisoners who are subjected to Israeli abuse.
We are here to stress that we will not disappoint our Palestinian prisoners and we will keep supporting them. Our prisoners are passing through difficult times inside the jails as the regime is attacking the prisoners, especially Islamic Jihad members.
Meanwhile, Palestinians consider the recent heroic escape operation of six prisoners from an Israeli jail as a slap in the face of Israel.
We are doing our best to release Palestinian prisoners, and this is an oath that we should stick with until all Palestinian inmates are free. We are working round the clock to hold meetings and put plans so we can liberate our prisoners and have them run us and with their families. Our resistance made a firm decision that the six Palestinian inmates that escaped Jilbo prison are on top of any coming exchange deal.
The Palestinian resistance mentors the behavior of the Israeli regime towards the prisoners inside the jails and those who remain free, demanding the international institutions to put pressure on Israel regarding the prisoners' issue.
The issue of our inmates inside Israeli jails is ongoing, and there are still two of the six heroic escapees out of the Israeli prison. We are here to express our total support for those inmates and all Palestinian prisoners who are fighting to achieve their demands.
Palestinians here stress they will remain committed to their duty of supporting prisoners and demanding their release. The issue of Palestinian inmates is a priority for Palestinians who will keep demanding their release until they regain complete freedom. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Demonstrations have hit Aden and other cities in southern Yemen. The protests came in response to the deterioration of public services and widespread poverty within areas controlled by the Saudi-led coalition's forces. But the demonstrations were met with a crackdown and resulted in deaths and injuries of protesters.
It is clear that the Saudi-backed regime has failed in handling of the economy, and this is what prompted people to go out and demonstrate in the southern governorates. The price of the dollar in Aden is two times more than what it is in Sana'a, and this confirms that former fugitive president Abdurrabbu Mansur Hadi is implementing the agenda of the Saudi-led coalition, which seeks to control Yemeni lands and destroy the country.
The governor of Aden, Tariq Salam, said what is happening in southern cities is the revolution of the poor that will only end with the departure of all the forces of the Saudi-led coalition, including the Emirati-backed Southern Transitional Council, which controls the city of Aden.
Yemenis took to the streets of Aden to create a major popular uprising aimed at confronting the Emirati occupation authorities. And this is a result of the suffering experienced by the people of Aden due to the absence of public services, such as electricity, inflation, and high prices. This is the revolution of the hungry, and it will end when all the Saudi coalition's forces leave Yemeni lands.
6 years ago, the Saudi-led coalition occupied several cities in southern Yemen, including Aden. Since then, These areas have been paralyzed by a power struggle between the Saudi-backed Hadi government and the UAE-backed Southern Transitional Council.
The catastrophic situation in southern regions of Yemen has pushed people there to stage out and demand expelling the foreign powers. Observers say people have come to realize that the Saudi-led coalition's presence has only increased the misery in their country, where more than 20 million people rely on aid. Abdulatif Roshali, Sana'a.
Since the beginning of the struggle for independence in Indian-controlled Kashmir in 1989, journalists in the troubled region have worked in dangerous conditions. The fraternity has often faced tremendous pressure from all sides, while many journalists lost their lives in the line of duty. New Delhi stripped Kashmir of its special status in 2019. Since then, the fraternity has accused the Indian administration in Kashmir of using intimidation, surveillance, interference and policing.
I think this is an attempt to treat journalists as enemy, the adversarial relationship that is there between the organs of the state and media as a fraternity is very adversarial at the moment since last 2-3 years. And this is a result of, you know, when you treat journalists whose only job is to tell story and who are storytellers and who are not responsible for the story. They are treating, as we call the shooting the messenger.
According to the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, the freedom of speech and expression in Kashmir is under threat. Michelle Bachelet has also criticized India for pressuring journalists and frequent communications blackout in Jammu and Kashmir. However, India has often rejected any criticism relating to Jammu and Kashmir. Editor-in-Chief of Kashmirwala, an independent media outlet of Kashmir, says his organization has several police cases registered against them.
In the last 2 years, we have been multiple times called, summoned, questioned, interrogated or detained. And other than that, there are a lot of other things that happen behind the curtains. You get phone calls, you get people who meet you and they tell you that this thing should not be done, that should not be done. So that creates this sense of fear in you. You always have to look over your shoulder as a journalist at what is going to happen.
The new breed of journalists in Kashmir say journalism has been criminalized by authorities in Kashmir, and many of them, like Asif Amin, are being compelled by their parents to opt for other career options. Journalists in Kashmir say New Delhi is trying to control media outlets and newspapers. They say their career is in danger. But many analysts believe in an era that almost every individual owns a smartphone and has access to social media, controlling a narrative is impossible. Shahana Bhatt, Internet Minister at Kashmir.
Farah, a Palestinian girl in her fifth grade of primary school, is one of hundreds of wounded children targeted by the Israeli regime. Shortly after the Israeli bombing of her house, Farah was transferred along with her mother and siblings to the hospital where their father.
Farah and her brothers and sisters were sleeping at home when the Israeli regime hit our house with no prior notice. They brought my kids to the very hospital where I work in. I was really shocked to see them. I've never expected to see my family in such a horrible condition. Farah was severely injured.
Farah, whose injury was highly critical, stayed for 7 days in a Shifa hospital, but her injury was severe and required traveling to Jordan for treatment. Unfortunately, all attempts failed to save Farah's legs, and she was eventually amputated.
Despite the fact that Farah has artificial legs, her morale is high. I thought that I would never see my child walking again, but now she's walking with her artificial legs.
Despite losing her legs, Farah is coming back from her treatment trip to take up her education in the school, where her teacher and classmates held a welcoming event for her.
I'm happy to be here and to see my friends once again. I'll do my best to continue my study. I know that I have to be strong and I will not give up my rights, whatever happens.
We held this ceremony to welcome Farah back from Jordan, where she spent a long treatment journey. Farah represents our Palestinian patience and resilience. She recovered from her injury and now is resuming her study. I have another 1,000 students here in this school, 20 of whom were injured during the latest Israeli escalation. Most of them have suffered from psychological stress.
Farah is now classified among a group of Palestinian children whose legs were amputated by the Israeli regime during the escalations over the Gaza Strip in serious violations of the right to life and childhood. Children in Gaza are one of the victims of the Israeli crimes. The regime has deprived them the right to live in safety. Nearly 70 children in Gaza were killed and hundreds were injured during the 2021 conflict. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
By the European Commission's own admission, the EU failed miserably to react when COVID-19 took hold in the 27-country bloc. In March last year, it was left to Russia, yes, Russia, to fly in medical supplies to the worst-hit nation at the time, Italy. This as neighbouring EU countries closed their borders while Rome cried out for help.
We responded with ad hoc solutions. But had we had HERA at that time, our preparedness and our crisis response would have been significantly different.
HERA is the Health Emergency Response Authority, a new €6 billion agency just unveiled by the European Commission. At the launch, EU Commissioner Margarita Schinas was attempting to big things up.
Europe is the most vaccinated country in the world.
Aside from calling the EU a country, people might be forgiven for thinking the EU had illegally annexed the 17 European countries that are not in the EU. HERA is going to cost €1 billion per year for 6 years, yet another big bill for taxpayers. Some EU lawmakers are wondering if it will work. After all, EU agencies never got to grips with the 2008 financial crisis or the 2015 refugee crisis. Activists claim the €6 billion would be better spent taking in desperate Afghan refugees. They say EU countries helped to create this latest refugee crisis, but are now closing their borders.
As long as we have people having to fly their home, go and be in either refugee camps or shelter where when it's available, we're not doing enough.
Regarding HERA, the point has also been made that the EU is inviting new health crises to the bloc by not sharing its huge stockpile of vaccines to poorer countries, mitigating the risk of new COVID-19 variants. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Whoever succeeds in meting out justice to the dastardly Trump would be doing a great favor to humanity and humanitarian causes, says Kahan International staff in an article published under the heading Yemen's Resolve to Bring Trump to Justice. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. There are some heartening reports from Saudi-aggressed Yemen. Despite the bid of the nefarious U.S. regime to prolong the unwarranted war by supplying Riyadh with more lethal weapons to kill civilians and destroy the infrastructure of the Arab world's most impoverished country. The first is the liberation of a large area of 1,600 square kilometers around the soon-to-be-liberated city of Mareb in the oil-rich province of the same name, and capture of some 550 mercenaries as the rest of the Saudi UAE-backed forces fled with their 12,400 wounded after suffering 3,000 dead in the several weeks-long Operation Intense Strength, in addition to the loss of as many as 1,500 military vehicles. The second gratifying news is the justice meted out by the government in Sana'a to a bunch of U.S.-Saudi-backed traitors involved in the assassination in 2018 of the then-president Saleh Assemad, with nine of them executed at Tahrir Square, and some others sentenced to death in absentia after trial, including the former U.S. President Donald Trump and heir apparent Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia regime. It was not disclosed how the authorities of Yemen would track down the heavily guarded American and Saudi officials to implement the verdict against them. If they succeed, it would certainly be a very significant step in international justice against the state actors of terrorism, especially in view of the fact that criminal Trump is wanted in several countries in many other cases, murder and destruction. Whoever succeeds in meting out justice to the dastardly Donald Trump would be doing a great favor to humanity and humanitarian causes. The war in Yemen, which is now in its sixth year, is indeed a tragedy of the modern world and an undeniable proof of the criminal terrorist nature of the U.S. regime and its clients. It would have ended in its first year if the American regime would have stopped supplying all sorts of lethal weapons to the Saudi aggressors, including bomber aircraft to kill civilians and destroy the infrastructure. The Saudis, for their part, were too afraid to risk losing their poorly U.S.-trained military personnel on a battlefield in the case of a ground offensive, are content to bomb the women and children of Yemen from the air, in addition to using the southern Yemenis as sacrificial lambs in the battles against the legitimate government of Yemen. The Ansarullah say they have the right to retaliate by targeting military and industrial sites in Saudi Arabia with ballistic missiles and drones in order to defend the lives and dignity of the Muslim people of Yemen. Analysts are of the opinion that the expected fall of Mareb to the government forces may bring the curtain down on the fugitive from justice, Mansour Hadi, whom Riyadh will get rid of as a liability no longer worth protecting in order to enter into peace talks with Sana'a, which, however, has made it clear that the only solution to the crisis in inter-Yemeni talks, and not any peace parties with the Saudi and UAE invaders.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khamenei's televised speech addressing the new wave of coronavirus, August 13, 2021. I spoke about the infection and death rates and the problems that ensue as a result of it, but this is one side of the matter. Another side of the matter is the extreme fatigue suffered by the health personnel. This is also a big concern. They are exposed to all kinds of physical and emotional pressures. So the health personnel, physicians, nurses, and other such people are doing an act of jihad. I wish to sincerely express my gratitude to these people, but my words of gratitude are of no significance. The most important thing is the gratitude of God, the Exalted, who is the thankful, the omniscient, and who sees all their efforts. I wish to raise some points with officials and some points with the people. What I want to say to officials is that during the spread of the disease, diagnostic tests became popular, which was a good action. This should be done. Both the health system and the mobilized forces, Basij, should help provide diagnostic tests extensively and for free. Today, these tests are not conducted for everyone free of charge. There are certain problems. Individuals should pay some money, which is expensive for some people. Things should improve in a way that diagnosis and diagnostic tests become available for everyone. Of course, insurance companies should help. The administration should help so that the issue moves forward and is resolved. The next matter is about the vaccine. Well, fortunately, a number of vaccines were manufactured inside the country, and domestic production helped facilitate the importation of foreign vaccines as well, as acknowledged by officials as well. As for the importation of foreign vaccines, the administration and the Ministry of Health had purchased the vaccine from certain countries. They even paid the full price for them, but they broke their promise and did not deliver on their end of the bargain. After our own vaccine entered the market and after the people began to use it, the situation improved and the path of imports was cleared as well.